Hey Larry, how are you tonight?
Hello, Andy. I am great. I am just looking forward to tonight's program. How are you?
I'm doing well. Just so you know, there is a thunderstorm rolling right over right now. May have to pause and all that because there are thunderheads like rolling over me.
Well, tell the good Lord to wave his wand or her wand and send those past.
Have you tried to kill any roaches this week?
I have not done that, although my wrist and I'm still in pain and limited mobility. I won't be doing that again anytime soon.
Please consider making us part of your podcast diet. You can find us at Registry Matters on your smart speaker or podcast app of choice like Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts. Also, if you like what you hear, please write a review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or any place like that. And if you don't like the podcast, just forget everything I just said. This show is supported by our patrons. You guys are amazing. You rock. You're the best. We love you. Thank you so very much, and keep the support coming. We appreciate it so very much.
And Andy, I wanted to introduce to our audience, we have a very special guest who I've become friends with, who's a very fine attorney out of Louisiana, Calcasieu Parish. He's a supervising life without parole attorney in Calcasieu Parish, licensed in Louisiana, California, and Texas. He's been on a number of our NARSL calls. He's helped us with our exhibit at the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'll get it right here in a minute. And our exhibition we do every year in Las Vegas in November. And we're so glad you would spend willing to spend your Saturday with us. We're going to talk about a very special topic that affects a lot of people who move around from state to state and even who enter the United States. On this episode, we're going to talk about interstate translation of sexual offenses. And I wanted to add to my already reasonable level of expertise, another person who's litigated. So, King Alexander, Mr. Alexander, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. Very pleased to be with you.
Appreciate you coming on. Can you, Louisiana is one of those states where there's a lot of life without parole. Is that true?
Louisiana has the highest percentage of its prison population per capita, or we have more lifers per capita than any other state, and it talk about a hockey stick graph.
Okay.
It's way up there. Now, I can brag a little bit, although you could say damned with faint praise. Louisiana is no longer first in the world for incarceration generally. Until recently, Louisiana had the highest incarceration rate among the states, which is the same as saying highest in the world.
Yeah.
And Mississippi was second. Recently, Louisiana became second behind Oklahoma, and now Mississippi is third. So, being, 49 instead of 50 or two instead of one in this case is not great, but it's moving in the right direction. There was a criminal justice reform in 2017 that helped get more people out. It's actually financially crushing the state, the number of people that they incarcerate in Louisiana.
And the southern states are also pretty notorious for being exceptional at their education systems too, aren't they?
Yeah, exceptional is the kindest way you could possibly put it. In Louisiana, I can tell you that the only things that aren't constitutionally protected in the way of appropriations is education and health care. And so those are the two areas that get hit year after year.
I used to live in Louisiana, and I would occasionally I end up over your way by Lake Charles. And there's that, I guess it's just a sulfur smell from the oil refineries.
Yes.
Oh God, it's a pretty it's not a smell that, it's not like a fried fish smell, but it's just something you're just like, ah, that's just
It's sulfur dioxide. Yeah, that's that rotten egg gas. Back in the day, when I was a child, and I'm 63 years old, but when I was a child, right through high school, the yellow smoke would go right by the I-10, would just drift right over the
Yeah.
I-10, and it was horrific. But the scrubbers that they use now, of course, the Clean Air Act, they've tightened up and tightened up and tightened up, and it's much better. But someone who's not around petrochemical and refineries would notice probably, you know, coming through here even now. I don't think we notice it that much, but I can say it has vastly improved.
Okay. It could be. I mean, I haven't been there since the early 90s. That's when I left the area.
Yeah, that's quite some time. But I remember back in the 60s and 70s, it was horrific. And now, if you came through here now, you might not even notice it. But you see them. Yeah, you see the petrochemical plants and the refineries.
Well, I'd like to make one observation about the high incarceration rate and the crushing costs in Louisiana, because Louisiana is actually one of those states that's notoriously efficient in keeping its costs per inmate low, because they rely a lot on inmate labor and inmate farming. And until a couple of decades ago, inmate supervision of other inmates. They ran a system where the inmates were in charge of the inmates, which kept their cost of prisons very low. But still, they're way lower than a number of states. So if it's crushing them, can you imagine what it would be doing if the states who spend more per inmate, dramatically more, what that same incarceration rate would do to those states?
It would be terrible, and I could tell you that one of the reasons probably why Louisiana has a lower expense is that Louisiana, uniquely among all the states, has this system of sheriff's prisons. And I can recommend a great 8-part article on NOLA.com, NOLA.com, which was the Times-Picayune newspaper out of New Orleans. Cynthia Chang wrote it. It's called Louisiana Incarcerated. And the object of the article was to determine why Louisiana has this tremendously high incarceration rate. And their conclusion was it was because of the sheriff's prisons. Instead of the state using appropriations at the legislature to pay to build prisons to house state prisoners, they tell all the sheriffs, all, and there are 64 of them because there are 64 parishes, you know, which are like counties. And they allow these sheriffs to finance one way or the other. Some were able to get local millages passed, you know, and sales taxes or ad valorem taxes. Others, every sheriff has bonding authority. And some of them floated bonds, and I was against it. I wrote letters to the editor against that, because if our sheriff was defeated twice at the polls wanting to build a sheriff's prison, and then when after he was defeated the second time, he turned around and floated a bond issue, and that's when I wrote a letter to the editor, said, look, the voters have already said no to this twice, and guess who's going to get stuck with that if they default on the bond? The same people who voted it out twice. But look at the perverse motivations there. The same person who has to cover his bond indebtedness has those patrol deputies out there in their units, and it's kind of like the cowboy who's got a horse and a lasso. You've got a deputy in a patrol unit and a parish jail. Yahoo, round them up and keep those beds filled. They get a higher rate for state DOC prisoners than they do for parish or city. And so that's the desirable one, that they don't start getting the DOC rate until they're actually convicted and serving a DOC sentence. But that's what they aim for, and that was the conclusion of this series of articles of why, what's driving the rate.
Hang on one second. Are you saying, like, the sheriffs can kind of make their own personal jail?
Yes. In fact, in Calcasieu Parish, there is the Calcasieu Correctional Center. And there's the Calcasieu Sheriff's Prison. And they used to just keep DOC prisoners in the sheriff's prison. But now they just shuffle them up any way they want. They find it convenient to separate some from others, you know, feuds right. And so on. And they do. And that way the state doesn't have to make the appropriation to build prisons. And so the state doesn't have to take into consideration what it's going to cost them to house more state prisoners when they pass another law, create new felonies, extend the length of sentences, create higher mandatory minimums, and all of that.
That's
being that I'm
crazy.
Being that I'm in politics, I can definitely vouch for that. That's how we ended up here in my state with the highest percentage of privately operated prisons in the country of our system on a percentage basis. I don't know about a total bed basis, but what you have is a very similar incentive. The state was able to increase its prison population without enormous capital outlay. Construction of prisons are very expensive propositions.
Sure.
There are lots more construction requirements than building a frame and stucco home with security and concerns and technology. So what you have apparently in Louisiana is the same thing. When they meet in Baton Rouge, they don't have to think about capital outlay, and that capital outlay is available for other things because the sheriff can float the bond, and the sheriff has got a good selling point because he can tell his voters it'll bring revenue in from the state to pay for the operation of it, and we're going to make money. I mean, it's a great system there, and I love it, King. That's just fantastic.
Yeah, and the sheriff has got a motivation to go out around looking for people to arrest and bring to jail and to put felonies on, you know, state felonies on, because if they can get someone convicted of a state felony, then as long as they're here after the sentence has passed, then the sheriff is getting a higher daily rate for the bed.
Now that
the author of that series, Cynthia Chang, I meant to mention, she's at the Los Angeles Times now. She's there now, but it's still up on NOLA.com.
Isn't that right, Larry? Going back to the conference, though, the attorney general guy, I forget his name, wasn't he saying
Mark Dan?
He was saying
very similar. Yes,
it was like you have the registry police running around and just making infractions kind of out of whole cloth to lock you up just to keep the system funded.
That's even more Wild West.
So yes, this is. I mean, we can have episode after episode on this, but yeah, it's a great system you have there in Louisiana.
Wow.
Oh, the probation and parole people and the other minders of registration, sometimes they literally are making it up as they go along. And I've challenged them in court at probation violation hearings for them to put their finger on the statutory law that they're telling the judge that my client violated. And they can't do it. And then ultimately they end up, you know, stammering, well, he signed a contract. And I say, well, judge, you know, a contract is something that's willingly entered between two parties. And then these people are being told that you have to sign this document that goes further than the statutory law. Otherwise, we're going to charge you with failure to register. Duress is one of the vices of consent, is what I learned in law school.
It's one of the basis for breaking a contract if it's entered into upon duress. It's one of the basis to set aside a contract.
And I actually had one client who was smart enough to sign the thing and then write "signed under duress" under his name when they made him do it.
Oh, I bet they love that.
They tolerated it, I guess, but he's the least of their problems.
I'm just dumbfounded.
They should have. Yeah.
The system we have is as hard. It's just if you end up trapped in it, you are just doomed.
And this became very apparent to me when I was just a regular felony defender and handling all kinds of felonies. I really saw that these people who had most had pled guilty to these registration offenses, not having any idea how bad it was going
right.
to be. And I soon saw what a terrible raw deal they get. And it became one of my big causes, and I've become known in Louisiana as kind of the registration guy. When they need a seminar, then I usually get asked.
Well, let's roll the show. And the first article comes from theappeal.org, and it's an article that talks about the criminalization of homelessness. There's a the second paragraph talks about a woman who is she's living in a tent, she's on sidewalks, she's in parks, and she keeps getting arrested. And to get out, she signs away that, hey, I won't go to that area again. And she has so many of them that she can't even figure out where she could go now. How you're allowed to be homeless in the United States, but then everybody says, not in my backyard, you can't live here. Where's someone then supposed to go?
You go to a place where you can not be around any people. And nobody owns the property. That's all you have to do, Andy, is find such a place. No people, and there's no owner of the property.
Oh, laughing here.
Well, chime in. Chime in.
Well,
feel free.
I can tell you that if you're talking about someone who's required to register, you don't have that problem. Because in Louisiana, homeless people, you're not allowed to be homeless.
Right.
If you have to register, and we have several people, I don't know the exact numbers, but we're about to start working on collecting that, because I think that is one of the things we do want to address with impact litigation, is there are a number of people around the state who are years at this point beyond the end of their entire sentence. They've served their entire sentence, but they are continuing in incarceration solely because they have been unable to identify a residence that would be acceptable
right.
to the state.
We talked about that last week of registrants then lying to their handlers and so forth because they don't, like, you know, my girlfriend, my wife, my my parents, they don't want to have their address listed on the registry. So now I have to set up residence somewhere, but then essentially go live somewhere else. So they have all these compliance officers that run around. There's an article about the school resource officers and tapping them during the summer months to give them a give them something to do. And it sounds just like this, that what you're describing then is that you have to essentially lie to figure out how you can go find a place to stay, because nowhere else that you would want to live or could afford to live or anything like that could get approved.
And this the system in Louisiana requires several items of proof where the person is living. And if they don't have certain bills in their name, then one of the things they can do is have the affidavit of a landlord saying that they do. But there is a criminal penalty for that landlord if the arrangement ceases and they have an affirmative duty to notify the state and the local authority that the person is no longer living there. And if they fail to do that, then they got charges themselves. So you have to have someone who really wants you there to actually sign an affidavit that's going there and it's got a warning about your criminal liability if you don't give the person up if they don't live there anymore.
Larry, can you speak to that? Because you've been in property management and you've kind of like railed a few times. Like, I am not going to have the big bad government telling me what I have to do.
I could tell stories about things that I did that I would definitely object to that law. I'm not able to keep track of when you're living there. If you happen to come stay with another person, and the person who you're staying with is actually renting the apartment from me, and you cease to stay with them, I'm only concerned about my relationship with the person who pays the rent. I generally look the other way when someone was staying there. I would not take the responsibility of having to know that you were no longer there. I just can't see that I would go along with that. I would want to help the person, but I think that the criminality part, I think I would have a good challenge against that. I can't keep track of who's shacked up with whom in my property. That's not my job. I got 112 doors to worry about.
Well, the state here would take the position, well, then you're not obligated to rent to that person, but if you're going to rent to that person, but that's only when tenant doesn't have the other means of required proof. They're saying then the affidavit can be used. If you don't have the utility bill and some other thing in their name, I think they require two forms of proof that the person is residing there. And in default of that, then you can use the affidavit. But that's where the rub is, and it is, just as you described it, a deal killer. Landlords don't want to go on the hook for that because possibly they wouldn't know, and who wants the hassle?
Absolutely. Well, if you're staying with an existing tenant of mine, most of the people that would be in the position of a jam like that, they wouldn't have the ability to rent their own unit. So the only way I would know would be if the tenant came and asked me, can I have a sex offender stay with me? But more likely, they would just have them start staying, and I would come to know about it through other intelligence mechanisms, and I'd go tell the tenant, I realize you've got a person staying here, and if you don't make it a problem, I won't make it a problem. In other words, keep the music down. Yep. Don't double park behind an existing tenant. Don't take another person's space. Don't do stupid stuff that causes me to have to intervene. But if I don't know, I don't know. But so how would I be able to be responsible? I don't know how that would work.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't be responsible unless you had signed the affidavit saying that the person was living there. There is no automatic responsibility to a landlord, but they do require that the landlord be informed. And we had that. We have a fellow he's one of these who's 2 years beyond the end of his sentence, and his sister, who is maybe somewhat intellectually disabled herself, had finally come up with an apartment the last time we had a review on him. We thought, oh, great, maybe that's the end of this nightmare. Come to find out when probation and parole contacted the landlady, and they told her, they said, so you understand he's a registered sex offender and it's okay with it. She goes, what? She never told me that. I don't want any child molester living here, and so on. And that was the end of that deal, because the woman didn't have the sense to realize what was required, that they have to absolutely know and be okay with it.
Wow.
While the article doesn't specifically address our people, but they say that on any given night, about 500,000 people are living without a home. 15% of those are chronic, which means they've been living without a home for many years. The demographics are very disparaging. So African Americans represent about 12 or 13% of the general population. However, they represent 40% of the homeless population. 10% of the homeless population are veterans, 10% of veterans are listed as homeless. So given all that stuff for like people that are not necessarily with a felony conviction of some sort, and then throw on the registry stuff, the homeless population has got to be very well represented by registrants.
Absolutely. We know it from Darcel with all the comments and concerns and inquiries we get. There's a significant number, and it varies from state to state. Of course, the wider they build the exclusion zones, it makes it more likely that people are going to be homeless. So if you go to Dade County, Florida, you're going to find more people homeless there with that 2,000 feet restriction that you would find than you would find in a place like Vermont, where they don't have any restrictions on where people can live, except for possibly people under supervision. But beyond that, in terms of the homelessness, I'd just like to take one moment to point out that I would like to think that this country is at least as great as it was in 1970. We have to be at least as smart as we were in 1970. And in 1970, after the anti-poverty programs had kicked in the 1960s, we did not have any real homelessness. We had an abundance and surplus of housing. Some of it was not totally desirable, but we had housing for anybody who wanted it. The homeless of 1970, we had reached down the point of only people who wanted to live a nomadic lifestyle that were truly homeless in 1970. And here we sit, 38 years later, 48 years, however it is, all these decades later, and we have to be at least as bright as we were in 1970. And now we have 500,000 people at any given time, and as many as 2 million in the course of a year that drift in and out of homelessness, according to this article. That's tragic that our country is not as good to now as we were back in 1970.
There really does seem to be an explosion of homelessness, and it's in the news quite a bit now. There are connections to, I guess, certain cities that seem to cater to the lifestyle and invite it. You had a lot of young people who ended up homeless in Denver, Colorado, because they went there because recreational marijuana had become legal. And other places that have free needle programs and so on, you're having more of it. You're reading quite a bit about San Francisco. I saw an article this morning about a woman who anonymously took out a full-page ad in the San Francisco Chronicle complaining about what she has encountered. She was menaced by a person who was schizophrenic and who had scissors and was clacking them on and off. So there's a little bit of pushback coming. But this discussion is reminding me of the case out of California, out of the San Diego County, California, Henry William Taylor, that involved parolees, and they had a residence restriction of 1,000 feet, maybe 1,500 feet. The one you mentioned in Dade County of 2,000 feet, that is pretty severe. Louisiana's got 1,000 feet for most things, three times that much for distance of residing from the victim. But what happened in Henry William Taylor, San Diego, of course, they have zoning laws, and particularly in California, they're very strict. You have to have the developers have to create a park every so often when they build tract housing. You have to have a park. And when you have the parks, so many parks and that close together, and you've got a 1,000-foot restriction, then if you look at the map, it squeezes those people out of those areas, and they ended up many of them homeless because of the restrictions, and they were bunching up under bridges and overpasses. And the litigants, and actually the Supreme Court of California invalidated the thing. They first analyzed whether a parolee is more like a person in the free world than a person incarcerated, and they answered that question yes. There are some restraints. They have less of a liberty interest than someone who's not on parole, but they more resemble a person in the free world than not. And they didn't even reach a decision on what the standard of review would be, whether it would be strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny, or rational basis. They said it would probably be intermediate, but they didn't have to decide that because it didn't even pass the rational basis test. If the reason for the restriction or the whole scheme of registration is supposed to cut down on recidivism, it's doing quite the opposite, because recidivism is far less when people have stable homes and stable employment. And these restrictions were making it so that they didn't have either one.
So, well, in terms of the homelessness, I don't think there's any one cause. We have a accumulation of a lot of factors, which really wasn't the topic of this podcast, but we have the economy, of course, has evolved, and the type of jobs that are available have evolved. The skills don't match the job set. We've decreased the funding for public housing altogether. We went to a voucherized program, and we never adequately funded vouchers. We've cut down on aid to dependent families. There's so many the institutions where a lot of people would have been that are homeless have been depopulated. I mean, there's just a whole combination of litany of factors. But all those problems existed in 1970. Every single one of those. And we have to be at least as smart as we were in 1970.
Well, we probably had more returning veterans in 1970 than we do today, too, wouldn't you think, during the Vietnam era?
I would think so. We don't have the national will. We don't make this a national priority. But my point is, I think this country is as good as it was in 1970 in terms of our ability to solve a problem. We don't have the will to solve this problem, but we could solve this problem.
I agree. And mustering that will, I mean, people who are convicted of sex offenses and registration, everything that's connected to it, I find it to be the most unpopular of causes. But I talk about it in groups of people who don't have to deal with it every day, every opportunity I can, because raising consciousness about it is the most important thing. I do see good articles on the Marshall Project,
if
you're familiar with that.
We've covered it.
On Theappeal.org, yes, and they cover it. And it is rising little by little, but we really have to push to make this something that the average person is aware of and that families talk about in their kitchens. Because the politicians are not really leaders. I'm reminded of Auguste Leroux, I can't remember, but it was the 1848 Paris Rising. And this might be apocryphal, but when the people in his district took to the streets and put up barricades, and he was later chided for going in and joining them because he was supposed to be a responsible elected official. And his remark supposedly was, "I had to join them. I had to follow them because I am their leader."
I had that quote maybe 6 or 8 episodes back. It says, "There go my people, I must follow them."
Yeah, there go my people, I must follow them. And my point is that politicians are not really leaders; they are really followers, and they will play it safe because they will, above all, want to maintain their position. And Larry certainly knows, having been around legislative things for a long time. And so, what must be done is to change the mind and to change the public opinion, and then eventually the politicians will come along leading from behind.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I've said that that's my theme on this podcast, is our public policies are a reflection of us. And right now it's a very poor reflection on us in terms of what we've prioritized and what we haven't prioritized. But that would all change if governmental officials started hearing that we want something done about homelessness other than locking these people up for these crimes that are so often associated with those who are homeless, if they say we're not satisfied with that, that is not an option on the table, they would stop arresting people for approaching vehicles for a handout or for sleeping on a park bench or for all the different things that gets a person arrested that shouldn't. Living in a vehicle can get you locked up in a lot of places. You got nothing else left except an old clunker vehicle, and you try to park it somewhere, they'll lock you up that as well.
Yeah, and it's just locking everybody up for everything is not the answer.
Well, but our citizens have to tell our elected officials homelessness is not acceptable in America, and we need comprehensive rehabilitation programs and reintegration programs, and we are not satisfied with your solution of locking people up. And if you want to lock them up, we're going to unlock you from the position that you have representing us. They're not hearing that. And when they start hearing that, that's what they'll start doing.
I agree. And I think that maybe if anything drives it, it would be the fact that rents are going up. Remember Jimmy McMillan, who ran, did he run for mayor of New York City or did he run for president? But his slogan was, the rent is too damn high. Remember this guy? He had distinctive hair and mustache and beard. And somebody even put out a doll that looked like him. That was his thing. The rent is too damn high. And I had an insight in New Orleans recently that there's this music and art scene that has sprung up in the Faubourg Marigny, which is across Esplanade Avenue from the French Quarter. And the music scene on Bourbon Street is just gone way down, and it's daiquiri shops, and it's just people walking around with drinks and cups and different, you know, really bass things blaring. But there's this whole really interesting with a different type of people and different types of music and different types of art all on Frenchman Street, where when I was a student, I lived there for a couple of years. But that scene wasn't going on yet. It has sprung up. And the insight that I had is, this happened because the rents on Bourbon Street are too high to support anything artistic like this.
Right.
I think that housing has to be addressed. We're hearing about how it's the rents in places on the coast and the Northeast, New York City, and on the West Coast are just, it's amazing when you hear these numbers. But to a lesser extent, we have the same phenomenon over the whole country. And a lot of people want to come to America, and America's, you know, they say we have a falling birth rate, but our population is undoubtedly growing by one way or another, and housing is going to have to be addressed. And I think that it should be the state's responsibility, that if you say that this person has to register and that you mean to keep them in jail or prison after they have completely served their sentences, but you don't provide any kind of state program for them to live not incarcerated, despite the fact that you're making them register, I think that should be the state's responsibility. And that is something that I think we do need to push with impact litigation.
I can imagine that wouldn't be popular.
You're starting to sound like a liberal.
You do. You sound exactly like that. You're going to have to raise taxes to pay for that.
And the only place, you know, but I mean, it's ridiculous because they're spending more money keeping that person incarcerated than they would have to spend for reasonable housing.
I've made that argument, Mr. Alexander. I've made that argument. In my state, we spend better than $30,000 per inmate. And I've just wondered, if you cut the person a $30,000 check and said, you get this each year if you've gone 12 months without engaging in criminal behavior and doing something to try to better yourself, I wonder, we could probably cut it down to $22,000.
We probably could.
but we're willing to spend the $30,000 because it creates a lot of jobs and it's an industrial complex running. But we wouldn't dream of giving those people any help because they need to support themselves and pull themselves up by the bootstraps. And I'll be damned if I'm a taxpayer and I'm gonna take care of these people. They've got it better in jails than we already have it in the free world. They have three hots and a cot, and they have better medical care, and they're sitting around watching cable satellite. It's ridiculous what these damn inmates, the way we're mollycoddling these people.
Oh, that's one canard after the other. They don't do three hots and a cot here anymore. It's a quaint expression, but they've made it, they've gone out of their way to make it so that people wouldn't actively desire to be in jail. And in the, you know, I guess 13 years at this point that I've been doing indigent defense out of a 31-year legal career, I've only had one fella who was in on a misdemeanor. It was probably a wino who told me at intake, now, don't do anything to get me out of here because I want to stay in here just as long as I can. I've had one out of all. Everybody else who read, so they're giving them cold meals. They're only getting one hot meal a day.
Yes.
And they've got more people in the dorms than the things were designed for. And
correct.
It's undesirable. And they don't want to make it too comfortable. And let's see, the medical care, oh, my God. There's a whole host of things that they refuse even to treat. I understand they're not treating anybody who has – they're not they're not giving people for hepatitis, and so they're probably dying of it in there. And when someone actually has to get medical care that is really expensive for the sheriff or for the state, then they're released. They're magically released. And, you know, and no one would have thought by reading the law books that ever could have happened. But it goes
I've seen it happen a number of times when it was particularly when they're in county custody, not as much in state custody, but when they're still a responsibility of the county jail pre-conviction, magically those bonds get adjusted and conditions of release are adjusted. And all of a sudden, when they have a need for significant medical care, the jailers find a way to backdoor the judges and everybody comes to an agreement and magically they go home. It's the strangest thing I've ever seen.
And they are very quiet about it. In my jurisdiction, frequently the women's facility is filled up, and they had, you know what a pirogue is? It's a little like a canoe, only it's made out of flat wood.
Yeah, I know what a pirogue is. Yeah.
They had women sleeping in pirogues in there because they didn't have enough bunks and rooms for bunks. They had them, these pirogues, out on the floor and had them bend down.
Oh yeah, they do that here too. Yes, totally.
Okay. And when the women's facility is full, then you have people simply being booked and released, and the sheriffs or the jailers who work for the sheriff will call the judges and tell them we need some relief over here, that we can't lock any new ones up until some of these others get out. And they very quietly are ROR-ing, which means release on own and recognizance,
right,
bonds. And but they keep it very quiet because they don't want it getting out on the street that, hey, they don't have any room in the jail right now, so you might have less chance of getting arrested for something you might like to do.
It kind of segues into moving on to the next article. That it's from the New York Times talking about our criminal justice reforms making the state safer, and they posit that the crime rate is at the lowest it has been. It has started to creep back up. But you would have to think at a certain point, you can't go to zero crime is what I'm going to say. But, you know, it has to find some sort of floor. And then you would just be kind of moving around with some noise of up or down at that point. But to what you guys were just saying about, it's not a deterrent necessarily. I mean, if you get out of prison and you can't find a job, you can't find a place to live, you are kind of then forced into one way of survival, which will put you back in prison. So no matter how bad they treat you there, you're gonna do what you have to do to survive. And
that's right.
That's what the article is laying out, that it at some point in time, it just doesn't matter that what the prison situation is doesn't really matter as a deterrent. But the liberals are more interested in rehabilitation and more programs and intervention and things of that nature, where the Republicans are more likely to emphasize prison over rehabilitation. But that's not even an exact science there either. I'm sure, you know, you have people on both sides crossing over to the other.
I am seeing that, fortunately. And actually, in Louisiana, the Republican Party beat the Democratic Party to the punch of endorsing the constitutional amendment, the state constitutional amendment that'll be on the November 6th ballot, to require unanimous verdicts. You know, Louisiana is one of two states, the other being Oregon, that doesn't have unanimous verdicts for all criminal cases. Although, for 100, we did until the, what happened was, the people who rebelled against the United States, at the end of Reconstruction, when their civil rights were restored, they immediately set about taking away the civil rights of other people. And one of the things they came up with, and part of the state prisons, Angola State Prison, notorious, was a plantation originally, and it was furnishing, in the absence of chattel slavery, it was furnishing agricultural workers. And there was a fellow who made himself a very wealthy magnate with convict leasing. But they didn't have enough convicts, you know, and he could make more money if he had more convicts to lease. And they said, well, here's one way we can take care of that. And we can also take care of the problem of having, you didn't have female suffrage yet, but you had the Negro male suffrage. Well, they made it so they could convict with 9 out of 12. And so, well, if we get 2 or 3 of them on a jury, why, we won't need the cotton-picking votes. And they proceed that way right until today. I mean, they actually said things on the record, and this went through 3 different constitutions, maybe 4, and it was kept in the 1974 Constitution. They changed it where you you could convict if you had two not guilty votes instead of three. You couldn't do it with three anymore, but that's crazy. And finally, and I was one of the people spearheading this reform, and it looks like we might get it this year. But that is one of the things they did. I feel like I've digressed and strayed from the point. Well, maybe Andy, you can give me back on.
I love the analogy though, because that's the only way we're going to win this reform effort is we have to get the Republicans on board. It's one of those things where if you don't get the Republicans on board, they're going to demagogue you if you try to do it. They're going to say you're turning loose the tidal wave of crime, like they said on Obama with his drug reform initiative. So you've got to have bipartisan support. We need,
and that is the point. And for this constitution, for this jury reform. That's a constitutional change. It required a two-thirds vote in both the Senate and the House. And you can't get that without it being deeply bipartisan. And we did get it. And the Republicans beat the Democrats on endorsing it. And the vote was very, very lopsided in the Republican State Central Committee. It was 87 to 17. That's like 82% in favor and just a handful against. And, you know, there were, you know, a few people that if the Democratic Black Caucus wanted good weather, they would be against it. But those people were deeply outvoted. And I'm seeing sheriff probably, I don't know whether Republican or Democrat, but it is Louisiana. And there's still a lot of the old yellow dog Democrats, you know.
But just to remind people, the Republican Party has not always been the right wing party it is today. I mean, you don't have to go back very far until we had a lot of liberal Republicans. We had Massachusetts represented by Edward Brooke, a senator, black senator. We had Lowell Weicker in Connecticut. We had Richard Swiker. We had a plethora of liberal Republicans across the country. And so this is a relatively new phenomenon that the parties have basically flipped. The Democratic Party stood in the way of a lot of civil rights stuff in the 1960s. And in fact, the reason why we lost the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court was because of Southern Democrats would not let Johnson elevate Abe Fortas to be Chief Justice when Warren Burger stepped down and announced his retirement in 1968. It's not always been the way it is today, but I mean, we live in the world the way it is today. Mm-hmm. Right now, the conservatives are in total control of the Republican Party, and they stand in opposition to most things we want to do, with a few exceptions like Rand Paul from Kentucky. But I would like it to be bipartisan. Mr. Alexander is a member of the State Party Louisiana Central Committee.
And that was my resolution for the I pushed it through. I picked up a co-sponsor, and we got it through. And a state senator, Republican, joined. In the Senate on that, and the party is solidly behind it. But they had to be reminded, though, that, you know, Frederick Douglass was a Republican and Abraham Lincoln was a Republican, and it was the Republicans who fought against taking away, you know, having these non-unanimous juries in the first place, and they were outvoted by Democrats, and that was in 1878. And then in 1898, the state constitutional convention they had that year, there was not even an active Republican Party in the state, and they actually said things on the record like, this is a little more than a family meeting of the Democratic Party of Louisiana, and we need to, this is one of a series of measures to restore, to assure the supremacy of the Anglo-Saxon race in Louisiana, and it was the Democrats. And so one of my points was, look, Republican fingerprints have never been on this. And if you don't get behind this reform now, the Democrats are going to hang it around your necks. And a lot of them are fiscal conservatives above all. And if you can show them that something is non-factual, and it's not making sense, and it's costing money that we don't have. States cannot print money. The feds print money, and most of us think they print too much of it. Well, then we have to do what works, and what works is, in fact, the reform from last year is called the Justice Reinvestment Task Force. We're getting more people out and dedicating the savings, dedicating the funds that we don't have to spend because those people are no longer incarcerated, into improving the overall criminal justice system. And it is deeply bipartisan. Now, fortunately, there is There is a Democrat governor in Louisiana now because the Republicans ran David Vitter before, who had some issues. And a lot of the conservative Republicans would not vote for him. They stayed home. And he will sign this legislation. Bobby Jindal, who we had before, I'm not sure he would have, but he was a terrible disappointment to Republicans and Democrats alike.
But so, Mr. Alexander, you say that, and if you're okay to, did you have something else you wanted to? I was going to move on.
Not really. I was just going to say that that there's plenty of liberal Republicans, and I miss one of my all-time favorites, Jacob Javits from New York, Senator. But we can move on. But I'm not bashing Republicans, all-time Republicans. I'm bashing the current crop of Republicans. I think some of them are coming around.
That's my point. I think some of them are coming around on criminal justice. Because liberty is a big deal to them.
Certainly. And the way that you guys brought that up, I reordered the articles around, and this article comes from Quartz, and new evidence says U.S. sex offender policies are actually causing more crime. And I moved it around just because of what you said. If they're fiscally conservative and you can present to them that the things don't work, that they will accept the message or, you know, change their attitude, whatever. But there's a mountain of evidence that these things don't work. Yet they are still pursued, and you know, even in the article they talk about, it says since the mid 1990s, legislators had devised increasingly Byzantine rules for those who have been punished. I'm not so sure I agree with your assertion that when you can present them that the evidence that it doesn't work, because their constituents are still saying no, not in my backyard. You can't have these people living here. You know, lock them up, throw away the key. And I don't know if you guys know about it, but there was a guy that got locked up in California for doing something indecent with maybe like a 14-year-old, and he got into a fight with a 21-year-old and he died.
Wow.
So, well, I'm not so sure it's a great situation.
Yeah, so what Republican is in office in California?
The last one left about 15 years
ago.
Yeah,
no doubt.
Okay, I mean, but, you know, I should have made it as a blanket statement, because some will get it and will vote accordingly, and others will not. And the ones who will not have to be turned out. And it is the fiscal conservatives who need to turn them out. And some people do seem to be motivated by this ignorant animus. And others are not. And I would hope that as we see a generational change on the American right, that it is more about doing what works and being frugal than it is about, you know, hewing to old prejudices and knee-jerk reactions.
And I wasn't slinging mud at you for what you said, just that the way our system is, and the people are calling in, just like the judge out there in California that got recalled. It's the people that are driving this bus and where they're getting their information or what they're fearing. The media is pushing that sex offenders are bad. And I'm not saying that it's great what they've done, but on the backside, even in this article, California passed a law in 06 forbidding parolees who'd committed a sex crime from living within 2,000 feet of schools or parks. Less than 5 years later, the number of them who were homeless went from 88 to almost 2,000. What do you want the people to do? If you want them to die, then you should have made a law that said they should die, but that's not what's in place. I'm definitely not advocating for that one either. But there has to be some alternative ground in there to let them live a life that seems profitable and productive.
Absolutely. If you're worried about recidivism, make sure they have stable homes and stable jobs, and that will minimize recidivism. With these politicians who want, some of them who even get it, and this is what we've seen in the push to eliminate the death penalty, because that's one of the things that Louisiana can't afford, and that I came, my journey to opposition of the death penalty was a long one, but I've been there for a good long time now. It doesn't work. It doesn't, it isn't an incentive or deterrent the way they always say. It deters that particular person, you know, but it really doesn't deter anybody else. And it's expensive. It's slow. It's really ought to be junked. And some of the hardcore pro-law enforcement people have come to that realization who are in the legislature and were ready to vote against it, but then they got chastised by their constituencies back home. And so in the House committee in Louisiana, we lost two votes that we had in the previous year that were yes votes for to let the death penalty repeal come out of the House Administration of Criminal Justice Committee. Two that were yes in the previous year were no this year. Well, we picked up two more yeses, but we ended up with the same ultimate split on the vote, and it didn't get out of committee. Again, it goes to educating the masses so that the politicians will fall in line, because the politicians will ultimately want to keep their seats. And term limits doesn't seem to have worked, because they have their eye on if they're term limited in the House, then they're looking at the Senate. If they're term limited in the Senate, then they're looking at some kind of statewide office or the Public Service Commission, so on. So you have to get to the electorate. And they don't have to necessarily switch parties to get there. It'd be better if both parties get there, because that's how we got this reform in Louisiana on the ballot. It was bipartisan and 2/3 vote in both houses.
Well, and then just point out that amendment you talked about was actually a public initiative in which California has that system. And this is an example of the people, or rather their representatives approved that, which made the thousands of people in the registry homeless until the courts struck it down. So it's, I always say, to a chagrin of a lot of people, a lot of our listeners, the people are not capable of analyzing the complexity of many issues and understanding the nuances. That was not something that should ever have gone to the people, because no one's going to understand enough about the issue to vote about what they did. There's too many initiatives in California. You get bad public policy when you just throw everything out to the people.
In California, there was a proposition that passed to ban gay marriage. A majority of the U.S. Supreme Court has said that you can't do that. But that was one of those things, and there were enough Hispanic voters in Texas where culturally they were more opposed to that, and so it passed. Sometimes I wish we had that type of proposition in Louisiana. We don't. And that's the problem that we have. For legislation to pass, it has to get out of committee, and therefore the composition of these committees becomes very important. Those members have a tremendous amount of power, and the people don't ever have an opportunity to vote on something like a constitutional amendment if it can't pass the floor. And even if it could pass the floor, sometimes it just can't get out of committee to get to the floor. And Larry, you could probably tell us a little bit more about how that works in New Mexico.
We sure can. There's a lot of things you don't want to get to the floor, because if you put it to the vote of the general membership, there's too diverse of a constituency that there would be too much support for it. So if you put it to the full House of 70 members, they would pass it. But if you put it before a couple of key committees that actually have more expertise, and they're not as likely to succumb to the mob rule, you can bottle it up in committee, and you never give those people a chance to vote on it because it's bad public policy. But if it gets put to the, you could look at that like a nominations. If this nomination makes it to the floor of the U.S. Supreme Court, for the U.S. Supreme Court, he will have broad Democratic support on the Senate, because if it gets out to the floor, they cannot vote against it, because they represent not only, you don't represent as a U.S. senator just the Democrats, but you're the representative of that entire state, and the people of those states, by and large, a lot of these states are represented by Democratic senators, and they lean conservative. So if it gets to the floor, he'll be approved with a lot of Democratic votes if he gets to the floor. And he will get to the floor, in my opinion, because the Republicans control the process and they'll get him to the floor. But that works in any legislation, not just Supreme Court nomination. If you can keep bad policy from getting to the floor, you can save the people from what would happen if you let the entire group vote on it.
So it does cut both ways. Sometimes you can stop something that would be bad and that would pass by bottling it up in committee, but what we're seeing with some of the reforms that we would like to get here, they're bottled up in the very conservative. You have one of the members of that committee was the former first assistant deputy sheriff of Ascension Parish, a fellow by the name Bacala, and I've gone back and forth with him. And then one of the ones from my area, it seemed like he was always carrying water for our district attorney. I finally reached him, and I got his vote on the jury reform here. And our district attorney, his name is John DeRosier, capital D-E, capital R-O-S-I-E-R. And if you Google him, you'll find that his stock is really going down. There's quite a few national articles and state articles about that are criticizing him for his various retro things. And he's not a Republican. He was a Democrat. I think he's no party now. But like I say, in this part of the world, you see both things on both sides. One of the big reformers on to reduce incarceration and to create transitional programs is actually a deputy sheriff. Or he's not a deputy sheriff. He is the elected sheriff of West Baton Rouge Parish. And those are increasingly popular programs. They're getting more support. They're getting some funding. Transition is really important, because what's the point of having people locked up and then letting them out if they're not going to succeed when they come out? You have to equip those people with the ability to succeed and give them the chance to stumble and not pay the ultimate for having stumbled. You got to get them back on track. So we have a veterans court here locally. We have a veterans court now. We have a drug court. They have DWI court, and we have mental health court, and these are all separately grant-funded, and they're very permissive in understanding and how difficult it is for people to overcome these particular things and get back on the productive path.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
This next article, as soon as I find where I put that page, I lost my
page. It's below your cursor, Andy.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, I have other windows pulled up too. I have other stuff going on here to produce this whole thing. You just sit there and read stuff and think. I got buzzes and wizards and widgets and things spinning all over the place. But this article
is from the Washington Compost. From the Washington Post.
Don't channel your inner Mark Levin. Ohio State and that part doesn't. Why sex abuse claims against men aren't taken seriously? I think really the ultimate answer here is they're not taken seriously for very similar reasons to that the women's claims aren't taken seriously. But from the men's side, it also then comes down to what is your manliness or your masculinity, and you know, where's the line get drawn if you're having, you know, they're talking about some wrestlers and maybe you're having I don't know how to put this politely. You're having your balls checked and maybe they hold on to them for too long. Maybe there's a little extra grabby, touchy move around. So, and the wrestlers are claiming that a particular individual was not being, very honorable in his medical practice, but then nobody believes them when they try and bring it to their attention.
Well, right. I'm familiar with that controversy. Yes.
Yes. Well, I would just say that for all the humiliation that goes for women, societal pressures are even greater on men. And I'm not trying to minimize anything about victim, either gender or sexual abuse. But if a man has been sexually abused, teenage boy or young man, or even taken advantage of by a power relationship. People work on Capitol Hill. A lot of young men work in the Capitol.
Or in prison.
That's how they're going to build their career. And to the humiliation is so severe of what they would be ridiculed for not being able to defend themselves. It's kind of like domestic violence. There's a lot of domestic violence on men. Not as much as women. But there's an awful lot of it. and it goes virtually unreported. Doesn't change my view that the burden is still on the accuser. So whether it's a male accuser or a female accuser, the person accusing of the crime should not automatically be believed, and we should not presume the person guilty. There is a burden of proof, and they need to come forward in a somewhat timely manner. We can't give someone a fair trial 30 years after the fact, whether it's a female victim or a male victim. But it's especially hard for men who have been abused sexually to come forward. Once they reach the teenage years, it's pretty much equal in terms of the research when they're in the childhood, when they're in the single digits. But when they reach puberty and beyond, society has built such pressures on males that they can't come forward.
I would think that the underreporting with men is great. And of course, the underreporting with women, and this, there are cultural differences from one culture to the other, because in some cultures, women who are sexually abused are condemned for it.
Yes.
And made to feel as if it's their fault. And that may have been true in this country, but I think we've come a long, long way on that. But I agree, yes, it is their burden to prove it, not the Sharia burden that you have to have four eyewitnesses. But for goodness sake, there should be more required than in Louisiana. They only have to have the one accuser to be a witness. That's sufficient. There doesn't have to be any forensic evidence. There don't have to be any corroborating witnesses. And the juries, if particularly if it's a very young person, when they're given the benefit of the doubt. And, in the common law, Lord Blackstone commentaries on the common law, Blackstone's ratio is it is better to let a guilty man go free than to it's better to let 10 guilty go free than to convict one innocent person. And this was axiomatic in the law. And so Blackstone's ratio is 10 to 1. I find in the child sex cases, juries tend to flip that completely on its head.
Right.
And they would rather convict 10 innocent people than let one real quote-unquote child molester go free. But back to the topic, as far as men, I think that we're not anywhere near as far along on it being okay with men and for men to or boys to just to become public or to report things that have happened to them because of the stigma. They, even if people around them aren't necessarily trying to make them feel that way, some just do. I would think that's terribly underreported. Or Larry, are you seeing statistics that bear that out?
Yes, I've seen it's underreporting. It's difficult to quantify, but people have come forward and said they were victimized. There's a huge cohort of male victims, and you just look at the teenage boys that Dennis Hastert was coaching.
And yes,
that is all too common. And these are young men who are big and strong and who are pursuing an athletic athleticism. And they're going to come forward and tell. And oftentimes these people, they have their pick of the team. They don't do that on the whole team. The whole team may not be aware of it.
The Jerry Sandusky case is another one that was very high profile. And things had been said to authority people who did not act on them. And that is the allegation with Jim Jordan in Ohio, too, that he was on coaching staff. And a couple of guys, and maybe more now than a couple, are saying that he certainly must have known, he knew or should have known, and didn't do anything, and he denies it. So that, just for those that may not know what we were talking about, that gives a little more background on it. Okay. But this is a phenomenon that is seen.
Well, it's underreporting is a serious issue for sexual abuse, but it's underreporting is rampant in other crimes, like I say, domestic violence. Women go years and don't report, but men go a lifetime and don't report it. Internal fraud is greatly underreported. People don't like to disclose that their systems were not adequate, and it makes them look bad. So there's a lot of internal fraud, particularly at managerial level and higher executive levels. They quietly go away. And so underreporting is a problem, but we don't throw away the burden of proof. If you didn't report something for 20, 30, 40 years, that doesn't change the fact that it makes it almost impossible for the person to get a fair trial.
Yeah,
for whatever your reasons were that you didn't report it,
we can't go back and undo and give the person the status they would have had to the evidence and the witnesses that may have helped prove or disprove your allegations at this point. We're sorry it happened. We're sorry that society dealt you the cards they did. We're sorry that it happened. But there's nothing we can do about 40-year-old allegations. And be fair, our system is built on fundamental fairness, I thought. And if we can't give you a fair trial, then I can forgive the person who's been murdered for not coming forward. If they don't report that someone killed them, that's kind of okay with me.
Come on. Yeah, how can you go that route?
Yeah. But otherwise, you've got to come forward in a timely manner. And we've got to promote policies that encourage people to come forward. But
I agree. There has to be finality. And these really, really long statutes of limitations that we see is another thing that whenever I get an opportunity to complain to a legislative committee about that, than I do. And the last opportunity I had to do that was in Louisiana. And this comes out of a case from my own parish. There was a OBGYN, an obstetrician gynecologist with a very high Tony practice in the upscale southwest part of the city. And that many of the society people had gone to see this guy. And he had a wife who was big in local Republican women politics. She was the head of the Republican Roundtable. And it turned out that her husband was collecting photographs that were taken of his patients, both of age and underage, without their consent. And an incredible number of them. His name was Dr. LaFuria. And because of what happened in that case, so I figured out that the bill was filed by one of the state representatives from this area, and he was one who regularly carries water for the district attorney, and it had to come from that case. It said that in cases of video voyeurism or that type, even still photographs, it would be encompassed within it. The statute of limitations would be for a person who was an adult victim, 10 years, but it doesn't begin to run until the victim knows that it happened. So you can't know when you're out of the woods on that. And I complained that I took the opportunity when talking to the committee about this, that these other cases with the underage, they've made it so that it's 30 years from when they turn 18. So in other words, that accuser has to be 48 years old before the person they might accuse is out of the woods. And it was much, much more reasonable. It was a 6-year statute of limitations before. And why did they do that? Well, the reason why they did it at the time was the now thoroughly discredited repressed memory theory that we saw in the Virginia McMartin preschool case and others like that. That is thoroughly discredited. There is no more justification for having done it, but they won't do away with it because
they can't undo it.
The prosecutors like having the power too. Yeah, yeah. They like having the power to decide if they're going to bring charge, get an indictment against somebody, but they know very well that once they get that indictment, most juries are going to, particularly even here, where they can convict with 10 out of 12. Now, hopefully, when this new constitutional amendment goes through, assuming it does, it will only apply for dates of offense January 1st, 2019 and later. So we're still going to have a tail of pending cases, plus we're going to have cases that haven't been charged yet, and some of those cases could be charged, upwards of 30 years, depending on when the accuser turns 18, is when starts the 30 years running. We could have cases, in 2050 that are being brought and still be applied to a non-unanimous verdict law. But I have to think, of course, I challenge the constitutionality of non-unanimous verdicts in every case that I try. And I think that after they've been done away with on the front end, then we'll start seeing the courts, particularly the federal courts, U.S. Supreme Court, come on and say that you can't do that at all, and anybody that you try has to be tried, as for the verdict has to be unanimous. But that's where we stand right now.
So, I think it's time for us to move on to this wonderful topic, which we received from one of our podcast supporters from Charles. Are you ready, Andy?
I'm totally ready. So we're going to be talking about essential elements. And I'm really just going to drop that in the middle of the ring, and you guys are going to go at it like a couple of feral cats.
I'm going to set it up for Charles. Thank you for sending that to us. And we were hoping that you could join us to hear that lovely accent to explain about your situation. But I'll do best I can with your message.
You said you're going to do the accent? Maybe,
I can't do that.
Okay.
But I'll tell Charles we wish you were here. He says, I was hoping that maybe the both of you could explain the meaning of essential elements. What are they? And he's referring to New York's registry statute that says that if you have a conviction from another jurisdiction, if it contains the essential elements of a New York crime, that they have to register. And he goes on to ask, well, what's the history on that? And why would they have done something like, why would they have enacted that? And the last part is a little bit easier. I can't give you the history because I haven't done the research. I'll look back to 2001, and they've had this in their statute since 2001, which is basically the entire history of the registry. My system, since I can't afford Westlaw, didn't go back beyond 2001, but this has been a part of their statutory scheme for many, many years. But they do that when people are moving from jurisdiction to jurisdiction to make sure that there's not a safe haven. If they just simply registered the list of people who had New York convictions, then theoretically anyone with a conviction in another state, that if they didn't attempt to ensnare those through some language that's inclusive, they would have safe haven in New York. So that's the reason why that provision's in the statute. But Mr. Alexander, let's talk about, you've looked at the New York statute. What do you think they mean when they say the essential elements of a New York statute? What are they driving at in terms of, before we get to the next part about due process, but what are they driving at in terms of what the hell do they mean by essential elements?
That's a good question. I like the way you phrased it, because just the phrase essential elements is... It's kind of nonsensical, because in order to convict of a crime, the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt every element of the offense charged. You don't have elements that are non-essential. Every element is essential. If they don't have all of the elements, then the verdict is supposed to be not guilty, or there can be lesser included offenses where if you have these four elements but not that fifth one, then it goes to a lesser grade of offense. So that's a little bit nonsensical to me, essential elements. But let's just disregard essential right now. The part that I think... resonates the most to me is at the end, but it is actually under another subpart, and they've listed a string of federal statutes that the elements of such crime of conviction are substantially the same as those which are a part of such offense as of the date on which this subparagraph takes effect. And that is from what we were talking about for your audiences, New York statutes, Article 6C, Sex Offender Registration Act, Section 168A, definitions, and then under Part 2D is where we were reading from, and the person who sent this in has highlighted in yellow that part I was just reading. So this is a comparison that most jurisdictions go through. I'm well familiar with the Louisiana statutes in this that are in Title 15, the revised statutes. And what that is that if a person moves into, if I can use my own state as a frame of reference, if a person moves into Louisiana or could have been convicted in Louisiana, but under an enclave jurisdiction, and by enclave, like if it happened at Fort Polk, Louisiana, and it was a military court, or if it happened, or if it was adjudicated in the Coushatta Indian Tribal Court, they have that here. I don't think it has felony jurisdiction, and we don't have any registration misdemeanors in this state, but that's just an example of an enclave. But usually what you see is someone who has a conviction from another state or perhaps from another country. I haven't run into the military enclaves or the tribal court enclaves, but those are things that come to mind, and they are covered by the statute. What the state has to do, and in Louisiana, it is a part of the Louisiana State Police under the Department of Public Safety and Corrections. It's called the Bureau of Criminal Identification and Information, the BCII, which is in charge of the Master Sex Offense Registry for the state. And they have their own attorneys, but I know that when it gets gnarly for them, they always consult with the head of a terribly named part of the Attorney General's office that the acronym is SPAT, which they just a few years ago under Attorney General Jeff Landry, piece of work, is called the Sexual Predator Apprehension Team. And many of us on the defense bar really resent that word or that phrase being used for our clients, many of whom are not, certainly not predators. Even if a person is guilty of the thing that they're convicted of or that they're charged with, they are a person in whose life something happened. They are not an offender or a predator, and language is important. And so I'm pushing back a little bit on that. But anyway, they have to look at the statute that the person was convicted of. And they have to find the Louisiana statute that they think is most like that foreign jurisdiction statute. And they make the determination. This is a very important process, and I would emphasize to anyone that they have the advice of competent counsel in this. Because you want to be able to make your case intelligently what you think it ought to be. And obviously, the person who has to register or had to register in the other state maybe is hoping that it's a non-registration offense in the state they're moving to, although Louisiana gets you both ways. They say you have to register if it's comparable to an offense that you'd have to register for in Louisiana, or if the state you came from makes you register for it.
Whoa. So let me get this straight. If you come from Georgia, where they register obscene telephone calls to a person under 18, and Louisiana doesn't register obscene telephone calls, as far as last time I looked at their list, you're going to register that Georgia person that made the indecent call to a minor, regardless of the fact that it's not a registrable offense in Louisiana?
Well, if it was just an obscene phone call to an adult, I think that is only going to be a misdemeanor in Louisiana. Louisiana doesn't have any registration misdemeanor. Well, but if it is Georgia, to a minor.
Yes, in Georgia they have that. I believe it is a felony then.
Right. Louisiana would probably call that indecent behavior with the juvenile under a revised statute 14:81. And because they have, words. Can be the indecent behavior in that. So, and so I have seen that. Yeah. Oh, yes.
So basically you'll expand your registry to include offenses that you wouldn't register if the other state registers them, because we don't do that in my state.
And that is a tier one registration in Louisiana, which is a 15-year registration, and it can be reduced to 10 after 10 successful if there was only one count, if there was only one felony conviction for the registrable offense. Go ahead.
Well, the point is that in my state, it has to be equivalent to one of our offenses. And we don't have a catch-all that gets people if they have required to register in another state. It has to translate. Now, we're deficient in our translation process, and we don't have due process, and we don't have a good system that does the translation. You have a bureaucrat that works for the Department of Public Safety who says everything translates to something. They go in with that attitude, and then you have to fight your way out. But yeah. if you don't have a translatable offense, it doesn't get registered here. You could come here and have a safe haven, but you're going to have to fight your way out of that bag, because DPS, the Department of Public Safety, is going to say it translates to something, if nothing more than an attempt to commit a crime. And then you're going to have to fight your way out. And then we have a case law that actually helps both sides on that. It helps State versus Hall, where a guy came from California for molesting the peace or something, a minor, something like an obscene telephone call situation. And he argued he didn't have to register. And the Hall court said that you have to look at not just the elements of the crime, which is language says a substantially equivalent, You have to look at the actual behavior and see if that would have constituted a sex offense here if you can't get it by looking at the elements of the crime.
Oh boy, that's terrible.
It could go both ways,
I guess. But see, lots of times, the offense of conviction is less than the behavior because it's the result of a plea bargain, or at least less than the behavior that was originally alleged. What they really could have proved if they had gone to trial, who knows? But upwards of 90% of convictions are the result of plea bargains, and so I fear. If they were to say that they could go behind the offense of conviction and look at the original behavior, Louisiana's is not written that way. Although I occasionally see the case where somebody pled guilty to something that I don't think the evidence would have supported, and therefore it cuts the other way, like you're saying. But yes, my understanding in Louisiana is that it's got a phrase, and I've written on this, and probably if I went back to my own paper, I'd find it. That I believe that they say, or if it's a registration offense in the other state.
There are states that do that, and I think you might have a possibly, and this is a question for you, an equal protection clause, because you've got a regulatory scheme. This is a non-punitive civil regulatory scheme. So you've got a regulatory scheme that says we regulate you if you were convicted of these crimes in our state, but we'll go ahead and expand the regulatory scheme to include you if you were convicted of other crimes in another state. We don't do that with a motor vehicle. If you bring a motor vehicle here and you have to do a smog inspection in New York City because they're very strict with their smog, and it's an older vehicle, and we don't say you had to do a smog in New York, so therefore we're going to impose that. Do you not have an equal protection argument, at least credible enough that you could assert that and say that they're applying two different regulatory schemes?
The thing is, equal protection arguments depend on protected class quite often. Otherwise, it's a rational basis. But I was just thinking while you were saying that I'm not sure this passes the rational basis test. If it's not a registration offense for someone who was in Louisiana the whole time, then what rational basis does Louisiana have for making somebody register in this state for conduct or for an offense that would not be a registration offense in this state? But I see it the other way around many times, because Louisiana, lots of times we're successful in pleading down a registration offense in Louisiana to Louisiana obscenity, which I think is 14106. And except for certain small parts of it, there are many things in it. But I think only for like a second offense of selling filthy literature, so to speak, to underage people, if a person gets a second conviction for that, then this obscenity becomes a second offense. But a lot of people are charged with obscenity in Louisiana who really, there ought to be a statewide misdemeanor ordinance for public urination, because quite often what has happened was somebody has just taken it out and somebody saw it and somebody called the law. Sometimes they're up to something sexual, and sometimes they're not. But that conviction is not a registration offense in Louisiana. But the problem we have is in that every state that touches Louisiana, that any obscenity conviction is a registration offense, and many other states beside. We had one fella who originally had computer aided solicitation of a minor, and ultimately we were able to get that pled down to obscenity, and he moved to Colorado, and we spoke to a leading public defender there to try to find out what would happen, and we were told, well, they could pigeonhole it this way under this statute that's kind of like an indecent exposure statute, or they could put it under this other one, and under this one he would have to register, and under this other one he wouldn't have to register, and that's exactly what we're talking about with this process that your correspondent has asked us to comment on. As it turned out for that client, we didn't hear back from him, and so I'm assuming that it went fine for him, and I think it did, that he was classified, that he didn't have to register. So they didn't do the worst there. But I fear, like you, that they're always looking for a way to make someone register.
I got 2 points to make on the response to that. First of all, I want to correct myself that when I said substantial equivalent, our language actually says equivalent. I was thinking about a neighboring state. Ours is just equivalent of other jurisdictions. But could Louisiana make the the argument that since the offenders have to register in the other states, that it would be rational not for Louisiana to have a safe haven. That's the reason why that we have this catch-all clause that we require you to register here if you have to register anywhere. Is that at least a somewhat credible argument they could make in terms of it being rational?
They probably might be. They could be thinking that way, that if we don't require people to register here for offenses that they had to register for in the state of conviction, then we're going to have sex offenders, quote unquote, coming to Louisiana because they don't have to register here. I think we see that situation a little bit. I'm seeing it with Kentucky, that people are finding that Kentucky is better than Louisiana and maybe better than a lot of other places. And they're encountering a much more reasonable system there. I had a situation where a gentleman from, he was a stonemason. I may have told you this story before, but he was from Minnesota and he had to follow the work. He had in Minnesota, I ultimately learned, he wasn't required to register in Minnesota, but he followed his work to Colorado. And Colorado may go by the facts. I don't know if they go by the – some states go by the facts, the original. They go behind the conviction to the original facts. And as you were saying, can cut both ways. But other states just go to the elements of the offense of conviction. For whatever reason, Colorado said that here you have to register for that. And then the man came from Colorado to Louisiana. And on analysis, we ultimately concluded that Louisiana was making him register simply because Colorado had made him register. He came to Louisiana with a Colorado license, and when our Office of Motor Vehicles saw that he had the codes, actually Louisiana has the Scarlet Letter Law, where it says in, you know, red or orange block letters at the bottom of the license, very glaring, sex offender. Right under there, and it's just horrible. And Texas didn't used to do that, but they do now. Because he had a sex offender's ID from Colorado, he had to get one in Louisiana. But then I looked into – that's when I had to educate myself about this and found out what we had to do to establish that he wouldn't have to do it. I saw that his facts and his elements out of Minnesota would have fit – in Louisiana, a misdemeanor carnal knowledge of a juvenile. It's a statute that has only existed since 1989, and we had to lobby for it. I wasn't in indigent defense at the time, or criminal particularly at that time, but the head public defender here is one of the ones who worked hard to get it. He's a past president of the criminal defense bar here, Judge Ron Ware. He's a judge now. And so there is a procedure under state law for getting that removed if you're convicted in Louisiana on facts on felony carnal knowledge, which is a registration offense, on fact which under the law that came later would have been a misdemeanor carnal knowledge. So this wasn't exactly that because he wasn't convicted in Louisiana. But just going by this type of a legal scheme that you compare the elements – he shouldn't have had to register in Louisiana, and it appears the only reason they made him register is because Colorado made him register. And then I had to obtain a transcript from Minnesota. Fortunately, I didn't have to wait for it to be made because up there they had already made it, even though it was a plea agreement, and it was in there, and they just sent it to me. And I was able to present it all, and the prosecutor approved it. And the way we found out that we had succeeded is the man got a call on his cell phone by the deputy who supervised these things and says, okay, you can go to the motor vehicles now and get yourself a regular ID. And the way the case had come to me is that he had a pending charge for failure to register, which is a new felony offense, hard labor felony with mandatory time. 2 to 10, at least 2 without benefit, although that's the way they had arrested him on it. And but the prosecutor had said, no, I see it as a failure to update, which is lesser. It was only a 6-month penalty, but it was with or without hard labor, which meant that it was a what they call a relative felony. And so The prosecutor wasn't going to dismiss the pending charge just because some cop had called him on the phone and said, okay, you can get a regular ID. So we had to ask them for a document that was something that he could put in his file. And once we got that to happen, then the charge was dismissed. And I tell people that I tell lawyers when I speak on this is that you'll never have a happier client than one that you got off the sex offense registry.
You're absolutely right.
This man literally kicked up his heels in my lobby.
Let's talk about due process. Let me describe the process in my state, and which is really more an absence of process, and then compare it to Louisiana, and then let's try to gear it towards our listener, New York, because he wants to know his British conviction. He received a 9-month sentence, and in his mind, that made it a misdemeanor level offense. I told him, no, we don't look at what was imposed. We look at what was available in terms of a misdemeanor. Generally, in most jurisdictions, is a year or less. But you can have a felony where they only impose a 9-month sentence, and that doesn't make a felony a misdemeanor because they only impose 9 months. But in my state, due process is virtually non-existent. You move in from another jurisdiction, and since you're registered, you're obligated to register within so many days, depending on the age of your conviction. You have either a 5 business days or 10 calendar days to register. And you go register, and then when they start looking at your offense, they start at the local level trying to figure out what it is, and then they tell you they're going to punt it to Santa Fe because ultimately it's decided at the Capitol, the Department of Public Safety.
But didn't you tell me that it's the locals who get to decide?
Well,
the local law enforcement?
They look at it initially, and they tell you what they think it is. They go ahead and register you, take your paperwork, and if you tell them you don't think it's a registrable offense, if they're remotely reasonable, they might tell you, well, we'll suppress the internet publication until Santa Fe tells us something. But then they send it up to Santa Fe for translation, and the Department of Public Safety is going to take the second look at it, and they're going to compare it to something administratively, and they're going to come up with their idea of what it translates to, and they're going to tell the local sheriff that registered you, this person is this type of offense classified as this. And then that's the end of the story unless you take the initiative, because they tell you you're a lifetimer, you're a 10-year, you're whatever your facts in their opinion warrant. And a lot of people go away and they never say anything else about it because they don't have any money or resources. But sometimes they contact attorneys and then I get involved, and we start by writing a letter to the Department of Public Safety, and we tell them, based on our research, we believe that the offense either translates to no registrable offense or it translates differently than what they have. And they write us back and tell us to pound sand, or they once or twice have agreed with us. But then if they don't agree with us, then our only option is to file a petition in district court, which is our court of general jurisdiction, for a declaratory judgment, asking a civil judge to declare the translation. And that can be very expensive because it's not a criminal. You can't run down to your public defender's office and say, can you file a petition for declaratory judgment
right.
for you?
Beyond the mandate. Right.
Yeah. Your only other option would be say to help with you people, I'm not going to register. I don't think I should have to. And then if you're indigent, the public defender could make those arguments that you would make in a declaratory action. But what would your process look like in Louisiana in terms of a person moving in? We don't need to worry much about people moving out as much as moving in. How would that process unfold if Charles decided to move from New York to Louisiana?
Okay, I can tell you that very particularly because I really studied it and I've written on it. I used to think that I knew that there was an administrative procedure that if you don't agree with what the BCII, the Bureau of Criminal Identification and Information, their decision of how they pigeonhole it, you can make an administrative appeal. And you've got a year to do that. But I thought that – but there is also a district court action. So at one time, because the statutory law wasn't very clear, that at any time during the registration, you could file a district court action. I thought the administrative thing was just maybe a way to save a little money, but you could always bring the district court action because you're continuing to be impacted by this. Well, I think it was in 2017, they put through – a statute that I wanted to speak on, and the chairman of House Administration and Criminal Justice wanted to move on to something else, and I had in a card asking to speak, and he didn't allow me, so I headed off the head of this sexual predator apprehension team and one of her attorneys there, and both nice ladies. And I spoke to them. Now, wait a minute. What is this meant to do? And they said, we don't. I said, your bill says, or the comments on the bill say that it doesn't change existing law. But if it does what I think you might think it does, then I think it does change the law. And they said, yes, this does. Bottom line, it forecloses a district court suit. If you don't file that administrative appeal within the year that they give you to do it, and that is, it's under the administrative procedure. They don't spell it out, but they make reference to the Administrative Procedure Act. And if you read those statutes, it tells you how it's done, and that the only, you only get to district court as a de novo appeal from what the ALJ, the administrative law judge, does on your administrative appeal of what the BCII does. So if you don't get a lawyer and make sure that you get as fair a shake as you can, or try an opportunity to persuade them you should be this offense that's either no registration or a shorter registration, a lower tier, then you are foreclosed. You only get to district court if you file there within 30 days of denial of your appeal before the administrative law judge, and then it goes up the Court of Appeals under the regular appeal delays, which are 30 days, and it has to be litigated as a civil matter, so it is a 30-day thing, and you don't get a public defender, but you do get full discovery, which you don't get in criminal. So they've made it a criminal thing. And also, there's a venue provision that you have to litigate it in the district in which the state capitol is situated, which I guess they mean the building because they spelled it O-L. That means the 19th Judicial District in East Baton Rouge Parish. So they did that because that's where the attorney general's are that do these, and they just made it easy for themselves that everything would get litigated there. We actually won some cases in the 14th that went up through the Third Circuit, and we got a great ruling in the Third Circuit that there's no juvenile ID flagging. And so that went up through the third Louisiana Circuit, which is here, but now that they've changed that law, and it's 15544.1, those have to go to the 19th, and therefore they come up through the First Circuit, and there won't be any more Third Circuit. But they went and changed the statutory law just by changing the statute that says how you get your license, that says that people adjudicated as juveniles have to have the scarlet letter on their IDs. And that registration is for natural life. You wow. didn't even have a right to trial by jury in that. And it's not supposed to be the same as conviction of a crime, but yet they impose this horrible thing. And even our Louisiana Supreme Court didn't realize that. And we beat them on that, and they turned around and really kind of snaked it through the legislature. They didn't change the notifications that you have to be given when you do the plea, which are governed by the Children's Code. If they had changed the Children's Code, then it would be on the notification you have to get, but it also would have gone through a particular committee of the state Senate that would have looked, scrutinized it more carefully, and it would have drawn the attention of the nonprofits and other groups that scrutinize everything that has to do with juvenile. They backdoored it, is what I'm saying. So my advice to anybody that comes into Louisiana is have an attorney. Don't come until you have the money for an attorney. You want to make sure that if you're going to have a problem with the way they classify you, that you act timely, that you litigate it seriously at the BCII level and the ALJ level, and then you observe all these deadlines. You've got a one-year.
Okay, so let's take it with Charles. Yeah. I think he might be an unlisted because New York doesn't list everybody. So let's presume for this question, Charles is unlisted in New York. He's having to register, but he's unlisted. The public doesn't know about him. He comes to Louisiana. He checks in. He registers with the local people. Are they immediately going to put him on the internet if he has any doubt about that? And then they'll deal with this later through that BCII process. What's going to happen to him or a person like him that moves into your state when this translation is taking place? They assume the worst because they list everybody in Louisiana. So I guess that's a stupid question to start with.
Well, you know, we have certain things that aren't. And one of my success stories is a fellow who had a misdemeanor carnal knowledge in Louisiana. And in Louisiana, the Romeo and Juliet clause that makes it a misdemeanor is a 4-year window, But I had to consult a Texas attorney, even though I am one. I consulted one. He directed me to the right statute. And in Texas, everything is called, everything of that nature is called sexual assault of a child, which sounds really terrible. We had to find the right part of it that applied to him. And it turns out that there, they don't have a misdemeanor grade of offense. They have an absolute defense to the whole thing based on a Romeo and Juliet affirmative defense. But here's the problem. The window in Texas is 4 years. The window in Louisiana was three. It's the other way around. The window in Louisiana was 4 years, but in Texas it was only three. And they were less than 4 years apart, but they were more than 3 years apart. Okay. And so we were sweating that when he and his family moved to Texarkana, that Texas was going to make him register. We didn't have them go volunteer to him, but he was already on felony probation, which Texas took the supervision of for something else, drug case. And so they knew what his record was. So it's not like he concealed his record from the officials there. And they have not made him register. So I think the reason is that Texas doesn't have any registration for misdemeanors. And this was a misdemeanor, but it would not have been a misdemeanor on his facts. And that's a case of where the offense of conviction is better than having them go behind the offense of conviction and look at the facts.
Absolutely. It goes goes ways. But Charles would, he would register, and they would begin publication, and then the translation would take place, and he would receive a notice. Would he receive a notice saying you compare to this offense, your British conviction compares to this offense, therefore you're a tier three. And then that starts the 1 year. Is that the way it works? He's got 1 year to appeal that that determination, that administrative determination.
And he has 1 year to appeal it in the
administrative law judge.
Administrative law judge. And then if he loses that appeal, then he's got 30 days to file for de novo review in the district court in the 19th district, which is in East Baton Rouge Parish.
And just for those who don't know what de novo is, it is a new trial, as if the administrative didn't, without deference to the administrative decision. Is that correct?
Right. No deference to the findings of fact. Just look at everything fresh. It isn't a tougher burden.
Well, normally that would be good, King, because normally if you're going with an administrative appeal, there's such extreme deference to administrative law that if you start out behind the eight ball because of the deference to the administrative determination. So that actually gives you the advantage to get a second bite at the apple. If you lose the administrative process, if you go to de novo review, you start from scratch and you figure out what you did wrong on your first go around at it, and you make a better presentation to the district judge.
I would agree. That's right. And you're right that the ALJ is going to defer to the findings that were made by the BCII in the first place. Now, with your gentleman who comes from the United Kingdom to New York, if he were to come into Louisiana, they may not become aware of what he has, but if such time as they do and they decide it's something he was supposed to register for, then right away he's facing a hard labor felony offense with mandatory time of 2 years out of the 10 is mandatory. And if it were a second offense, it actually upgrades to 5 to 20 or something.
Well, he would need to report in because he's registered in New York.
Oh, he is registered. He is registered.
So he would have to.
Oh, he would.
To close that loop, he would have to report. And that's what I tell people. You can't make your own determination that you won't have to register in another state. Even if you've contacted me about my state and I tell you that, although I'm not an attorney, I'm the one that the attorney is going to call for the translation in all likelihood, and I say that that's not translatable, 99% chance you're not going to have to register. You still have to present yourself to register so Santa Fe can release you. That closes the loop because Santa Fe is going to notify the state that you came from that you presented yourself and we're not interested in you. And that takes you out of the registration system because the state that you left otherwise would put a non-compliant warrant out for you because you left that state and your registration renewal came and went and you didn't report in. So you're going to be wanted. The marshal's going to be looking for you. So you have to go to the new state and at least initially present yourself. And people have a problem with that. They say, well, I'm not going to have to register there. It doesn't make a damn. You still turn yourself in to that to those officials, and you try to register. And if they say you're not covered under our law, then they close the loop for you and notify the state that you were registered in, that they've seen you, they're not registering you, that it's done.
That's right. Otherwise, they feel like you're trying to get by with something, and you're liable to get a charge for it, and it isn't going to be anything good. If the shoe were on the other foot, and he were not required to register in New York, and just comes here, and assuming that he won't have to register here, that could be the rude awakening too, when the record becomes known to the authorities. So you would have to find out. And I just cannot emphasize enough how important the advice of counsel, timely advice of competent counsel. Not everybody knows this law who practices law, is familiar with this area. You want someone who does practice in this subject matter of the law and do it timely. It could be that it's not required, but if it were required by the other state, I think Louisiana says it's required here. But again, like I say, I had one case where Louisiana required it because the previous state had required it, but it wasn't that state's conviction. It was another state's conviction who did not require it.
I can beat that one, yeah. King. I can beat that one. A guy contacted me many years ago. Somehow the word's gotten out that I'm supposed to be a guru about registration, and he contacted me, and he said, I've got a real dilemma. He said, I have a Wisconsin conviction from 89, 91, somewhere before he was required to register, and they didn't make it retroactive in Wisconsin, so he didn't have to register. He decided he was going to get into the time the economy went south, he decided he was going to get into the gambling business, and he went to Vegas. And they reached back way back decades, so he had to go get his gaming license. He went down, and they said, well, we'll be happy to give you a gaming license, but you have to register as a sex offender because you've had a conviction since 78 or whatever their year is. And he said at that time, Nevada was not listing people on the internet. They just have gone to this screwed up system they have with AWA compliant. But most people in Nevada at that time were not listed, and registration wasn't nearly as bad. And he went ahead and registered. But even despite that, he didn't care much for being registered. And he decided he was going to return to Wisconsin. Well, in the meantime, Wisconsin had changed the law and said that they didn't change it, make it retroactive. But they said if you were required to register in a state and you moved to Wisconsin, you would have to register. So he was moving to Wisconsin with a requirement to register in Vegas based on a Wisconsin conviction that didn't require registration. Wisconsin said, don't tell us your problems. The statute's black and white. It says you are moving here from a state where you're required to register, and you will register here.
What a revolting development. But again... I don't see the rational basis for that.
Well, no, we extracted him from the registry because he was off paper before he would be required to register by state, and he figured that out on his own initiative. He said, I've done some research, and I said, well, I'll tell you, I don't invite people to come to my state, but I will tell you that your research is spot on, and your theory will work, and you could move here, and they would not register you. They would tell you that you're not required to register, and that would close the loop with Nevada, and then you could move back to Wisconsin as an unregistered person, and that's exactly what he did.
That's great, you know, but it's just so ridiculous and so Byzantine. This is something that really cries out for uniformity, and I think if the feds impose uniformity, it would be more reasonable than most of the states are.
Well, that's the problem. The feds can't impose uniformity because they are state registration schemes, and the feds can't have a uniform scheme because there's no federal registry. What I've advocated is that I don't know if you're familiar with the Uniform Law Commission, but that's how we get uniformity among the states is we adopt uniform laws. And the Uniform Law Commission is the place to go with such a proposal. And I, through one of the members of the Uniform Law Commission, put together such a proposal for uniformity. But by the time we got that to the commission, they were so far along with that on Wall Street that had already been adopted, and they were in the implementation period. And the Uniform Law Commission said, well, you're wanting us to take on a study that's going to cost a lot of money. You don't have an industry group. It's different than when you have an industry group that wants to fund the uniform study of, like, for example, the mobile home, the making mobile homes real property so that lenders could fund those. Well, you had the mobile home and the lenders and all those industries willing to help come up with a uniform law. But the Uniform Law Commission is the way you would go if you could get a uniformity among the states. But the problem for the states are that would require some states to decrease their provisions and some states to increase their provisions to be uniform. You'd have the states where things are not as tough, and there's a few where they're not as tough. They would have to increase because nobody's going to go to the Vermont model that has the Florida model.
And that's true. But with uniform acts, though, even uniform acts aren't really uniform because the states can and do tinker with them. I was thinking along the lines of federal preemption because of saying – we have, you know, the commerce clause power, and there's this right to travel.
Now, I don't believe a Republican would be talking about preemption, first of all. That seems like something a liberal Democrat would say.
Well, I mean, but some things are natural to the commerce power, and for people to be able to move from one state to the other. Privileges and immunities clause. I mean, well, I'm a constitutional lawyer. I'm a civil libertarian. You may say I'm a Republican. I call myself a legacy Republican because my parents were both state central committee, and that's where I could have some power. That said, I tend to be a small government person, but and I believe in states' rights, which you know, which the left liberals have lately discovered. But still, some things just seem to present themselves as more naturally. Because when you encounter exactly the kind of problems we're talking about here, problems moving from one state to the other and taking a job in another state, and you run into problems that are so bad that it just shuts everything down. I had a lady call me from Oregon, and she was from a family connected to a very famous running shoe company. And she was a track coach and had become involved with one of the minors that she had coached, and she was referred to me that she had contacted the lawyers in my city, and they got me involved. And I talked to her on the phone, and as soon as she found out that Louisiana has the scarlet letter on your ID, and that was it. She was in love with somebody here and had to move here, but she said, well, maybe I'll just visit. I said, well, if you visit more than so many times, so many days in a calendar month, you know, then you have to register probably both places. Yep. But when she found out how onerous Louisiana registration was, and she changed her plans. And that's what you got to do. You have to find out in advance. And some people maybe don't have the choice that precipitously they have to move and they have to deal with it. But in those cases, you want to get good representation and make sure that you don't get a raw deal, because you can find out you got the wrong deal. And if you didn't make that appeal within 1 year, then you're SOL.
Well, King, can we make this another topic about the preemption and coming up with because I floated the uniform law model and got some traction, but that's a whole topic that we could spend some time on. So I'd love to have you back. We're nearing the end of this session, and I would like to do a couple of shout outs. See what did Andy just tell me?
That's a good idea.
I'd like to do a shout out for our Narsil in Action, which you're going to be on Thursday night. That starts at 6 o'clock Eastern time. I don't know if you're going to be on the entire thing, but we're going to be talking about scams against registrants. We're going to be doing an hour of Can They Do That? And we're going to be talking about the Michigan class action lawsuit that was filed last week to try to broaden the reach of the Doe versus Snyder decision. So it's going to be a great jam-packed 3 hours on Narsil in Action. And you're going to be with us for what part of it?
Whenever you want me, as far as time goes. But
I definitely would like you on the Can You Do That?
I have myself down for on my own calendar for what would be 7 p.m. Eastern.
So, well, I'm looking forward to that. And Andy, did you want to do our normal closeout of how do people get in touch with us?
Because absolutely. I've
closed my sheet.
No, yeah.
But it's been a great podcast, and I'd love to have to explore the uniformity and further about the importance of an attorney, because most people are not going to have that resource, and they're going to want some advice on how to do the research in advance. So we can talk about getting an attorney and possibly doing research in advance before you end up in these situations like folks often do, and it's too late.
And let me add that SOL means statute of limitations. But I mean, when you think about it, it's pretty much the same thing, right?
I was going to say, does it really matter? Is this just a distinction amongst words that doesn't really matter?
It's a distinction without a difference.
Right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. That was a lot, and more than my little feeble brain with computers can handle.
Well, and thanks to Charles.
We couldn't do it without you, Andy.
Charles is the one of the first. I think we've got one other person, but he's already registered for the 2019 conference.
Wow.
That's in Houston.
You haven't even registered.
That's right next door to me. I'll be coming to that one.
Oh, sweet. Look forward to meeting you.
And I'm fudging a little bit. He's registered because he won a registration.
He's the one that won?
He carried it over because he wasn't able to make Cleveland.
Okay.
But Charles, we look forward to seeing you. And it was a great, great topic. And thank you very much. And everybody who has ideas for topics, please send them in. And Randy's going to tell you how.
Yep. And thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Alexander.
My pleasure.
Share the podcast. We need to grow the audience. And you can find us at registrymatters.co. You can call and leave questions or voicemail or text me, 747-227-4477. Gmail is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, the best way to support us is go to patreon.com/registrymatters. Thanks y'all very much. Have a great night. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Mr. Alexander. Look forward to seeing you Thursday.
Thank you. Bye.